We're here.
Hello.
Welcome all. It is Wednesday night, generational change. I'm Jen.
I'm Peter, and I've got a bad hair problem.
You know what?
Alfalfinator back
when
there.
When you move closer into this neighborhood, we are going to find you a stylist, and you're going to find somebody who can give you a good haircut, okay? That's going to be our mission.
Jen has informed me that I can no longer go to a barber.
No, you're a grown man and you get these like little boy haircuts at the barber.
But I look like a little boy.
You know what though? It's not. No, you're a professional person now.
If everybody's doing well this evening, we are really going to have to channel our abilities here.
I want to pull something.
Jen has something that she wants to share.
No, please go start because this is going to take a few seconds. I want to see if I could possibly set this up.
So we have some really good news. We have a very important story that we are going to be covering. We are going to be talking pretty extensively about this insane anti-solar bill that just passed the Senate in Tallahassee with the help of the Democrats, no less. And we are going to have the privilege of going on for the first time together. Jen has gone on before, but we will be going on Status Quo with Jordan Cheriton to discuss on Friday.
You've been on Status Quo. You've sat there before with Jordan. Not as an interviewer.
Yeah, that's right. I have.
You've been on with him before.
Was that
when
you're
just sitting there?
Status quo?
It was status quo.
Well, this would be the first time you and I would be on together in the studio doing our thing.
I mean, always a milestone somewhere.
Mm-hmm. So that'll be a lot of fun. And we are hopefully going to have an opportunity to get some more exposure to our channel, talk more about these very important stories. And there are plenty of important ones to talk about.
This is his 11-point plan. Oof. This is what it looks like.
Oh, this is
is his plan. But I doubt
he came up with it himself.
I don't care. I want to know how to. I want to share this because we only need to look at like the key. I want to go through the key numbers. We don't need to go to the details. Just the key points, like that. And there's an 11-point plan. I think that this is something that since Shahid can't come on right now, that this is worthy. Because I think people should know this, that if you guys are not aware,
yes,
our Senator Rick Scott, also to me known as Voldemort.
He is Voldemort.
He is honestly one of the most despicable human beings ever. But
that
he has come up with an 11-point plan. He has a plan. And Mitch McConnell actually isn't too keen on this plan. So there's going to be... Now, who knows what his problem is with it? I'm sure it doesn't. The fact is, it's more of a list of platitudes, really, than a plan. But this is his action plan. And
if anybody doesn't think that Rick Scott is going to run for president, they don't know how much Ron DeSantis and he actually don't like each other. So to say that he is very likely going to run would be an understatement. So he's going to run. And these are the
11.
So it's the 11-point plan that mm-hmm. he is going to be running.
You need to get rid of that because I want to scroll through.
All right.
So guys, this is Rick Scott's 11-point plan. Okay. And we're just going to go through, like there's pages in between that have more details on this, but I just to give you an idea of what he thinks the direction is, like what's needed here in this country. So this is number one on his 11-point plan. Our kids will say the Pledge of Allegiance, salute the flag, learn that America is a great country, and choose the school that best fits them. Translation, he wants charter schools and choice because he can profitize and basically screw all the poor people. So that's that. This is number one. Kids will say the pledge.
We want your loyalty and you will deliver it.
You will salute the flag.
I mean, could you imagine? Rick Scott really is like the president of 1984. Like that's him. He is Big Brother. He has the look. He has the style. Okay. Government will never again ask American citizens to disclose their race, ethnicity, or skin color on any government forms.
Translation. I don't like black people, and I don't like that there are certain people that are trying to give them a fairer chance. We don't like that.
I hate to say it, but this unfortunately is one of those points that is going to resonate with a lot of people. Because there's a lot of people who don't like
Translation,
this.
I don't like black and brown people. Mm. Okay.
So. That may be part of the course for one or some.
Okay, here's number three, people.
Mm-hmm.
The soft on crime days, meaning all the over-incarceration. The soft on crime days of coddling criminal behavior will end. We will refund and respect the police because they, not the criminals, are the good guys. This is number three in his national plan. So just pay attention. Like, this is where his priorities are. Like, this is what's needed in this.
You know, people would be a lot more accepting of a tough on crime type of country if we actually had a country that didn't profit off of crime.
Right. If it was in, well, then you wouldn't have what we would have.
Well, exactly.
Okay, number four.
You know, those two, you know, they always forget that part. It's like they start correctly and then they don't finish correctly.
Okay.
So it's only one or the other.
Four. And this one is a personal favorite. Okay. We will secure our border, finish building the wall, and name it after President Donald Trump.
Excuse me while Rick gets off his knees because he's been there for a while.
I totally thought that I totally understood why Rick did this, and he is a wonderful person, tremendous guy. He understands what's necessary.
Seriously, people, this isn't his plan.
At the altar of Donald the man Trump, and that's what he's doing. He's just giving the people what they want, and I am a man of the people. Really great guy, tremendous.
Okay, guys, number five, also so important.
We will grow America's economy. Starve Washington's economy. He used the word starve Washington's economy and stop social.
This is the fifth part of his plan. So we're going to grow our economy.
Yeah.
We're going to starve Washington's economy.
Hell yes.
Even though he feeds off of that, suckles off that tea quite nicely. And we're going to stop socialism because right now we're so socialist the way that corporations are taking over our country.
Well, again.
And the way that workers have so much control over their working conditions. We're really socialist.
Well, he's running for the president of Florida, if you couldn't tell already. Like that's the president of Florida's
moniker. Oh my God, people!
Right,
but okay,
so he's got that down.
On to point six. Let's see what we have here because I didn't get through all of these because I just could. Oh yes, austerity. Yes. Okay, speak to me, Rick. What is he saying?
If only Steve Grumbine were here right now to read number six. We will eliminate all federal programs that can be done locally and enact term limits for federal bureaucrats and Congress. Now.
That actually doesn't bother me.
That doesn't bother me either.
And it actually is a policy at least. Like it is at least a plan where it's not just a platitude. So,
but
yeah.
Here's the thing. What Rick Scott is effectively saying in the first part, this is austerity politics 101. This is, we want you to literally be afraid all day, every day, that you are going to be in abject poverty. You are going to be in misery if you don't work like a slave. And that is what they want. Eliminate all federal programs that could be done locally. Translation, we want to make sure that you can only do things that are within a balanced budget. Or it's like PAYGO. That's what that is. That's PAYGO. That's PAYGO.
No, here's what, to me, this is what I hear. Translation, we will eliminate all federal programs that can be done locally. Translation, I don't like poor people. They are not my problem. Pull yourselves up from your bootstraps. That's the translation to me. So let's move on to seven. Let's see what we have for seven. Okay, guys. So we will protect the integrity of American democracy and stop left-wing efforts to rig elections.
Does that mean they're going to stop left-wing efforts to rig primaries?
No, they don't care about that.
No, not that part of the equation.
Can't we just all agree that everybody is rigging elections? Everybody.
Imagine having a plan where you specifically have to, this is divide and conquer strategy. This is all about how can we effectively divide into teams.
Our efforts to totally rig elections.
The left does it, the right does it. And
but the left generally does it against itself. The left does it against progressives.
The left just sucks at doing it against Republicans. That's really what it
they
is.
They haven't figured out how to do
no,
that.
No, not as good as the Republicans can, that's for sure. Number eight.
Oh, family values. Okay. Do you want that?
We will protect and defend and promote the American family at all costs. Because if I were still alive today, I would let people know how important family values is. That is how I became president, and that is how everyone has copied me for the past 40 years.
Okay, translation of number eight. We will protect, defend, and promote the white, hetero-American, normative, Western, Judeo-Christian family at all costs. Wealthy family. Next. It's most ridiculous. No. What is the American family, Rick? He has no concept. Oh, this is beauteous. Men are men, women are women, and unborn babies are babies. We believe in science. Not really, Rick.
Well, if you believed in science, Rick, then why, when you were the governor of Florida, say we will not be discussing the science of climate change ever?
And forbade anybody in the entire state government from using the term climate change. That's somebody who really believes in science. There you go.
Science for thee, not for ye. That is how this works, ladies and gentlemen.
Men are men, women are women. Oh my God.
Men have a penis, girls have a vagina.
Translation. I am very insecure about my manhood. And
he probably, you think he's got like a...
I don't know about that, but he probably needs to constantly be visiting his friendly neighborhood urologist.
Maybe so. Well,
but the point is, unborn babies are babies. We believe in science. Clearly not, actually. So clearly not.
He
anyway.
Really goes into the running for the worst politician in the United States.
This is like horrible. He really, he's so evil.
Really
right, let's
tries
see what
hard.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
So this is a big one, guys.
Yeah, this is one of my favorites.
One of the things that we've always talked about, and this is one of the reasons why we really try to form as many relationships with libertarians as we possibly can, because libertarians truly do believe in the separation of church and state. But they, of course, fall in line and vote for the Republican. Well, this is Mr. Republican going full bore into the theocracy element of GOP politics. Americans will be free to welcome God into all aspects of our lives. All aspects of our lives. And we will stop all government efforts to deny our religious freedom and freedom of speech. He had to put that freedom of speech.
But it doesn't even matter that, because the whole thing about we are free to welcome God into all aspects of our lives. But here's the thing, and he's not an idiot. He's very highly educated.
Oh, he absolutely is.
So like, he also knows that the free to welcome God is the same thing as free to not welcome God. And that would be me. I'm an atheist. Never believed. Never did. To me, God and Santa Claus were always the same concept. Like, it was just never anything I believed in, ever. I don't have an issue with other people believing that. But to be honest, I don't want that in my public school. I just don't. So, you know, Rick, take your God and shove it.
Yeah, for real.
The only downside for me about not being gated is that I'll probably have to deal with the Jehovah's Witnesses again. I had a nice reprieve from them.
And finally, last but certainly not least, America First. We are Americans, not globalists.
And now, I'd love to see his investment portfolio.
Now, unfortunately, this is another one of those points that will resonate with a lot of people. No, we are America First, but we live in a multinational world. And if you think that it's you know, again, I believe in America First when it comes to our economy. And I think most Americans believe in that. At least I hope they do. But that's not what he's talking about.
No.
That's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is corporate special interests must be America First, not China, not Russia, not anywhere else.
And yet I would love to see what his portfolio looks like. Because he wins either way. That's the thing about people like Rick Scott. They win either way. So it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Oh, you could stop share. We could be done with this.
I just want people to see just what.
Oh my God, that's a good one. Oh my God. It's just not good. But you got to go into StreamYard. You got to go into StreamYard and stop and then share again. So you got to stop that.
All right. So remove.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So we've got that out.
And now you have to go to share. Yeah.
No.
Stop screen.
Oh, it is stop screen. Sorry.
Okay.
And share. And share screen.
Yeah.
And
so he really feels the need for everybody to see what this person looks like. Most people here know what our guy looks like.
Tell me that's not an evil son of a bitch.
He's Voldemort.
Like, how do you not see just how, like, he's sinister? Like, he is. You can see that he's soulless.
He's the dark triad.
Yeah, he's soulless. Voldemort. Like, he really is. Yeah, that is a man who...
Make it go away, please. Make it stop. Just, oh my God, make
it
stop.
He's praying, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, he's so
He's sorry. Trying to pretend like he has a heart, but he can't find it. Because it's just not there.
He doesn't give a crap.
No, he really doesn't care. But that, unfortunately, is...
He's the wealthiest person, isn't he? Like the wealthiest person in the Senate?
$250 million of wealth. That's a lot of money. A lot of money.
Yeah.
Who knows
he's
how
the wealthiest
much money,
person in the
and
Senate.
And who knows how much money he's got in offshore accounts that you don't know about. You know, he's somebody who...
America first, or wherever my money is invested.
Let's get to work. But again, he is a great politician. We're not taking that away from him. And Carrie, you are absolutely 1,000% right. When God starts paying rent, I'll let him in.
Exactly.
That makes sense. But God doesn't pay rent. In fact, that's one of the biggest scams in our country is start a church. That's tax exemption, baby. And of course, Alexi is worth between $200 and $250 million. And that's just what's on paper. By the way, if you haven't seen his palatial palace in Naples, Florida, right on the beach, baby. Hey, it's amazing.
It's disgusting.
It's amazing what Medicare blood money can provide you.
It's amazing what sociopathic, you know, behavior will do for you.
You're right, John. We do. Because taxes, because unfortunately, yeah. I can't put that up. But John is absolutely right.
Yeah.
Because there is no separation of church and state anymore. They believe, much like when Ted Cruz was running for, you see, this is the thing. Everybody remembers the Trump and Bernie phenomenon. But the one thing that always stuck with me with the 2016 presidential election was how much of a theocratic campaign Ted Cruz was running for president and talking about this, like there was no line between God and country. And in his mind, they were one and the same. And that in itself is.
I'm sorry. It was me for a second. Okay. I'm sorry.
It's okay. If they don't want to have a separation, then fine.
Well, no, they think that, see, that's the thing. They care about their freedom to practice religion. They don't give a crap about the establishment clause.
Correct.
So they only see it from the one side because they love the idea of prayer in schools and all of that, but they don't want to, you know, they don't want to tax those people. See, that would be the thing. At least then they would sort of be being, you know, kind of consistent.
Well, that's the whole thing about Democratic Party politics is, Republican Party politics is they are very good at blurring that line. They really do a great job of convincing you that they are all about freedom and this and that. But there is no freedom the second you cross church and state. And I was listening to a speech from the great Ronald Reagan, who said that, you know, he once knew Thomas Jefferson, and he said that, Bill Clinton, you are no Thomas Jefferson. Well, I guarantee you, if Reagan was the nominee in 92, he would have beat Clinton. Yeah, there you go. Jesus for president. You know, am I going to need some type of a... Yeah, Jen, fix it.
But I'm trying to help you in the big picture. We need to find you a new stylist.
We'll find a new stylist. We'll make it work.
When I hear Jesus, I think of Anthony because he looks like Jesus.
So we're doing a reverse today. We are going to have our wonderful panel, which is going to come on in 6 minutes. And then right thereafter, we will have Shahid Puttar coming on to talk about his campaign
against the lady who can't keep her eyes open anymore.
But the problem is... When you do it, it almost seems like you're mocking people that have like Parkinson's. And I know you're not, but that it's not a good look.
Okay, fair enough.
I still think it's funny.
Okay, it's not. Because what you're doing is sort of like to seemingly be drunk and intoxicated comes off as sort of mocking somebody who might have something wrong with them.
That's fair. Hit the like button and share, guys. We really appreciate it. Want to let you know, for those who are coming on, we are going to be going on with Jordan Chariton of Status Quo. We are going on his show.
Woo!
On Friday, I believe at 5:30 p.m.
And is it just us or is there anybody else going?
Just us.
Very exciting.
And so we will be discussing a horrific bill that just got passed in Tallahassee in the Senate. Now, is it likely that DeSantis will sign it into law? Very likely. But anybody who has just unfortunately been blanketed nonstop with the Don't Say Gay bill, and that is important, but there was a bill that just got passed through a bipartisan effort in the Senate on the behalf of FPNL, which is an anti-solar subsidy bill, which means that if you had any intention of having solar in the Sunshine State, well, now it has just gone up ridiculously high in terms of cost.
They've just completely disincentivized solar.
And driving here, seeing that the gas is at $5 a gallon, and we have a way to reduce those costs, and our state is screwing us out of that with both parties, mind you. I don't want to hear nothing from anybody about how the United States is screwed, this, that, and the other thing. We need to be drilling for oil. No. What we need to be doing is moving to a clean energy economy. Economically, environmentally, and foreign policy, it all makes sense. And the idea that we're not doing that just goes to show you how corrupt our government really is at the local, state, and federal level.
You know what, Alex Murphy, willing to bet Scott is a climate denier? No, but who he is if he were in the movie Don't Look Up, he'd be one of the people that would be planning for his escape pod.
Absolutely.
So he believes it's happening, but he'd have no problem selling you that it isn't. So that's the thing. Like, he's way too smart to be a climate denier. He just knows that it sells wrong.
Rick Scott is one of those guys who, unfortunately, is not only in a position of immense power, but he also believes that your life is meaningless.
No.
You are just a peasant peon who is there to serve him and the aristocratic class of this country. You have no value. You are just there to fill space and make sure that he lives as high on the hog as is humanly possible.
You know what? I used to give my kids references so that they would understand like what the economy looks like and stuff. So I used Hunger Games at one point with Reese. And I said to him, I'm like, you know what? Just be fortunate that we get to live in District 1. Like, that's basically what I say, you know, like how I explain it. Like, we are not the people in charge, but we, and I'm talking to him about in our life, live in a very privileged manner. We're not District 12. You know what I mean? And to me, District 12, I think of places like Yemen and Haiti, and like, that's sure. District 12, right? So, you know, but that's how it goes. And people like Rick Scott only care about what's going on in the Capitol.
That's true. Only in the Capitol.
Only in the Capitol. That's the point. Exactly.
Oh,
and Shahid is coming on. I saw a comment go by about that they thought it was Shahid. Yeah, he's coming on afterwards. He had something come up, so he's coming on after we talk to Harvey and Alan.
But anybody, and the last thing I will say, and I'm going to say this with Jordan.
And we're going on Friday, correct. And it's a daytime thing.
Correct.
What time is that?
5:30. Okay. So what is very important to note, when the Democrats ask you for their vote in November, you will bring up the anti-solar bill and how three Democratic senators, including one who's supposed to be a progressive champion, voted against the public.
Name names. You mind? It's public.
Senator Victor Torres. How could you do that?
Oh, Senator Torres. And he says he's progressive.
So,
in other words, he's the assigned baddie on this one because they had to do whatever.
They had three of them.
Well,
because three GOP senators voted against it. And why is that? Of all the things, you'd be very surprised. As it turns out, FPNL, which is, again, energy monopoly, it is the only game in town in the state of Florida. For a state that is so free and so for the freedom, as we like to talk about, there is no freedom regarding energy.
See, and my Republican friend locally, I'm not going to mention names, who is running again for state house, he is somebody that would be very much not in support of that bill.
Correct. So that's why we need to have this greater consensus with people who are about non-corporate, you know, efforts, because that's what it's about.
And again, in our state, it is red, but there are old school red and that are care about things like Everglades preservation and care about things like that. So, I mean, it's not what people necessarily think. Is
Alex, if you only knew, if you only.
That's what I said. Yeah. I just addressed that before. He's not a climate denier. He absolutely knows it's possible. It's happening. He knows that, but he's going to sell you that it's not. He's going to be fine either way. That's what I'm saying. He's like in the Don't Look Up. He'll be having his escape pod.
And unfortunately, Matt, because of how bad things are right now in terms of economics, opportunity, the country as a whole. Yeah, there's a lot of nihilist people out there who are like, yeah, just blow it all up. And one of the reasons why we are doing this panel this evening is because we do need a 21st century Bill of Rights. And it's primarily around economics. And who better to explain
We've needed it since FDR.
Yes, we have needed it since FDR.
This is something that should have happened then. Well, I mean, it probably should have happened, you know, forever ago, but, and we still haven't gotten this. And it's basic things, people, basic things.
Well, with that said,
we're like battered spouses.
You're ruining my intro.
I'm so sorry.
You're so bad at this.
I'm so sorry.
Don't put that down.
I'm a little baked. All right.
Yeah, just
all
a right, little sorry. Bit. But a very good friend of Jen's is joining us again, and he's bringing a friend. So this is going to be a wonderful conversation. It's Professor Emeritus at University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. You know him, you love him. He is.
Well, it's my favorite cheesehead.
He's Larry David in disguise.
No.
But this is funny.
Larry David is Harvey in disguise.
Yeah, you know what? You might be right about that. Harvey K., welcome back to Generational Change.
It's great to see you two. Alan hasn't shown up yet, huh?
Oh, he's here.
He's letting him in. Okay. He is a journalist for the LA Progressive.
He always does this like it's a boxing. Every time there's more than one person, he always does it like we're sitting.
And in the left corner, coming out of fighting LA Progressives in Los Angeles. No, you know him. He's a great writer. He's Alan Minsky. Welcome to Generational Change.
Oh, welcome. Yeah, Harvey, you know, this is a showdown here, Harvey. Who's going to win the championship of the 21st century economic bill of rights?
Well, we better get it going soon enough because people really are getting restless and they're acting like, hey, yeah, I'm on the side of Putin now. You know, this nonsense that we have to read about. So,
well, according to Rick Scott's plan, we're going to rid ourselves of socialism. So that'll be that.
Oh. Well, I mean, if we just rid ourselves of socialism, wouldn't that just make the world a perfect place to live in, guys? I mean, isn't that what we're missing?
We're so socialist right now.
You know, I don't understand. Alan's in California, which, you know, great weather. You guys are in Florida, great weather. Yeah. How come they can be so different as states? I just don't know. So it just means that we do not live in a weather-determined polity.
Well, yeah. I think it has to do with how both states were settled and, you know, just the sensibilities of different places. You know, Florida's biggest problem, probably as much as anything, is just the fact that it's always been a state that has always had horrific problems with education. And when you start there, and Florida is very interesting, as you know, Harvey, because it has a lot of good higher education institutions. But regarding K through 12, I mean, Florida's 48 in the country. And that's always interesting. But of course,
the worst part is that, and when you look at it proportionate to where we are wealth wise.
Yeah.
So like 49 and 50, it's probably like Arkansas, Mississippi, West Virginia, like generally the poorer states. And then there's Florida's down there. And we're one of the wealthiest states. That's the thing that's like disgusts me the most. But yeah, I digress.
Yeah, there's no question that where we sit today, a lot of it is centered on where education is and why people are not paying attention to things that are necessary. And we're always getting distracted. You know, we were just saying the other day, not that the bill isn't important, but the national airwaves, everyone was talking about the Don't Say Gay bill. And yet nobody, and I mean nobody, was talking about the anti-solar bill that took a bipartisan effort in the Senate to get through on behalf of FPNL, which is owned by NextEra Energy, which owns the Dakota Access Pipeline. Everything is connected. It always has been and always will be.
But Don't Say Gay was the wag the dog, and nobody was paying attention.
And not that that's not important, but it doesn't affect the economy. This bill does affect the economy and the environment and foreign policy. And Alan, you can speak to this very well. We've got $5 a gallon gas. You've got $7 a gallon gas out in California right now. And if we are not moving to a clean energy grid, we have to literally be asking. It's like we have a death wish at this point. It's so bad and it's so interconnected. So wherever you guys want to start, the 21st Century Bill of Rights, the floor is yours.
Harvey, do you
want to
go first?
Sure, I'll take that on. Anyhow, as I was coming on, I heard the two of you speaking of FDR didn't get it. We still don't have it. But the thing is, the idea of an economic bill of rights in some ways is built right into the Declaration of Independence. How else can we understand life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Or as FDR once said, to have life, you've got to have the wherewithal, okay? And that's the same for liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And when he presented the Economic Bill of Rights in its earliest form in 1933, he actually said what we need is an economic declaration of rights. So he was standing right on the shoulders, so to speak, of the declaration. Anyhow, in 1944, he went before the nation for the state with the State of the Union address, or what they then called the annual message. And what's very interesting is that we can talk about it as FDR's Economic Bill of Rights, but what empowered him to give that speech and to call for the rights that he called for is the fact that in 1943, the year before, not too many months before, yeah, it actually had a major university polling group, survey group, do a study of what Americans wanted to do. What did they want for themselves and their children after the war was over? And what he discovered is they wanted, or as one person, one of the pollsters said, they wanted everything, but most fundamentally, they wanted guaranteed health care. They wanted guarantee that young people could pursue education as far as their skills, qualifications, and intellects would carry them. Okay. They basically, they wanted what we would today call social democracy. And so the Economic Bill of Rights includes those kinds of things. Now, it isn't very clear that he expected it to pass at that time, but he offered it as a vision for the post-war world, well, post-war United States. Now, what's also interesting about it is it definitely was popular. Not only did 85% of Americans want those kinds of basic rights, but it's also the case that the labor movement, both the American Federation and the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and what was then a growing civil rights movement, all three of these forces aligned with FDR and pushed his campaign, in fact, to the point of a fourth presidency. And in the wake of the war, Truman briefly had made an effort to try to pursue them. But what really I found interesting, and I had forgotten to include it in our statement, but I think it's worth noting, is in 1960, the Democratic Party platform reaffirmed the Democratic Party's commitment to pursuing an economic bill of rights. Now, that wasn't high on Kennedy's agenda, you might say, but it was, in essence, what underwrote or pushed or propelled intellectually LBJ's pursuit of the Great Society of War and Poverty. As well in that decade, A. Philip Randolph, the great labor and civil rights leader, he proposed a freedom budget to end poverty in America, to basically to end poverty, to guarantee work for all. And it was modeled after FDR's 1941 call for the Four Freedoms and most especially that Economic Bill of Rights. And then the last historical note I'll make is that not long before his assassination in 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. reaffirmed the idea and called for an Economic Bill of Rights. So we heard it come up again with Bernie Sanders' campaign to some extent in 2015-16 and most definitely in 2019-20. It was solidly on his website, though he did not actually campaign aggressively on it. So this past year, Alan and I, as we came to know each other, and by the way, just as a footnote to this, I feel like Alan and I have known each other a hell of a long time. We've only known each other now maybe for a couple of years, and we have yet to meet because of the pandemic. We have never been in the same room. Only Zoom rooms have we shared together. So there you go. And so we talked about this. Alan is the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America. I was invited by the Gravel kids, I call them, to do an Economic Bill of Rights video.
It's a good video.
Thank you very much. Nina Turner got very excited by that. Alan and I were already friends, and she kind of encouraged us to take it further. So Alan actually began the first draft, then I came into it to do whatever I do to it. And I'm really excited. I think this might be a time for it to gain traction. And I'll leave it to Alan to explain, but we see it as not only essential to reaffirm the progressive commitment to the Economic Bill of Rights, but it may well be the only way the Democratic Party can effectively run in 2022 and capture the popular imagination and bring people out to vote.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's a lot there from everything Harvey said. And a sort of negative inspiration belongs to Bill Maher in that he did one of his New Rules segments in which he was just defining progressives entirely negatively around cancel culture and the sort of elements of wokeness that turn people off in the mainstream media. And of course, that's not what the progressive movement is about in the United States. And at its core, I think what it is about creating an inequitable and just society for everybody. And I think it needs to be made clear to the general public, as I see things, is that, and I don't want to be too exclusionary around who's a progressive Democrat and who's not. We welcome all elected officials to join the progressive ranks. Right. Once upon a time, up in Wisconsin, the most famous progressive in the country was a Republican, after all, right, Harvey?
Right, that's right.
So that's a long shot for the contemporary Republican Party. But nonetheless, I see right now, after 2016, the United States political environment nationally is made up of really three significant political tendencies, and they're jammed into a two-party system. You have the Trumpian reactionaries on the right. You have what I consider basically a conservative sort of status quo tendency that runs from like the Mitt Romney wing of the Republican Party through the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. So they take what is now a more popular term now than it was 10 years ago, but call it neoliberalism or sort of free market, economic driven politics, sort of post-Reagan politics as adopted by Clinton also inside the Democratic Party. That's the status quo. That's the economic system we've lived in for 30 to 40 years now, and people are very dissatisfied with it. And then there are the progressives, there's a post-Bernie Sanders campaign progressives. And of the three tendencies, only one of them wants to recreate an American economy that is basically the template that most Americans want to see. And I think that's what we've set out to outline here. Of course, the Economic Bill of Rights is a very ambitious anti-poverty template. It's also equally an ambitious pro-middle-class template. And this is about creating a society where you have, again, social mobility, where you have opportunity spread throughout the society, where you have comfort, where you have vacation time, where you have well-funded public education, and where you actually have a sane public health system. So this is a much more prosperous life for the average American. And even if you are among the wealthy or among the successful courtier class in society, I think you should give this special consideration, because this will be a much more agreeable America to live in for everybody. And that's what we're setting out to not only create a template for, but to announce at this moment, it is this political tendency, the progressives, post-Bernie Sanders, progressive Democrats who represent this, support us in these midterms. We don't have a presidential standard bearer in the midterm election, but we do have great candidates running all across the country, some of them even in Florida. And Jen, you would have been one of the Jen, you didn't throw your hat in the ring this time, did you?
This was strategically, it's not a good year. We still don't even have our district lines. They're holding off to the latest possible minute. And this would have just been a train wreck. You got to be smart about it. I wanted to go back to something you said. Were you suggesting that overall as a society, we're better off with happy and healthy and educated people?
It's a crazy idea.
I'm just wanting to make sure.
Come on, haven't you read Rick Scott's 11-point plan?
I mean, the fact that people don't get this has always been very weird to me. Like, I don't understand how anybody is better off with other people being unhealthy, less educated, and unhoused. Like, I don't see how that benefits anybody.
I think that there's
like, what am I missing?
I think that there's always a tendency when society especially is in not good shape, and right now it's in really bad shape.
Yeah.
It kind of exacerbates some of the worst kinds of human tendencies, which is always, envy, greed, and pride. You see it all too often where it's like, yeah, I know things are bad, but I could be like that person over there. So I'm glad I'm where I am right now. And that's the politics of a Rick Scott, who I think is one of the most dangerous people.
Oh, he'll get you kicking down.
And so when we think about that type of, and that's why we really harp on the idea that, you know, libertarians really have to make up their mind regarding, you know, what they see their political futures being, because we do share a lot of commonalities, but it's so obvious that corporate politics is going to be the death of us if we don't get away from it. And the 21st Century Bill of Rights is a pathway to getting away from that. And right now, especially with what's going on in Ukraine, it crystallizes so much more how so much of the crumbled infrastructure, no pun intended, of the United States is breaking at the seams. It really is. Like right now, we could have a clean energy infrastructure grid that could mitigate this problem, but we don't. And the only reason we don't is because big oil captured our government on both sides.
Mm. By the way, for what it's worth, I am a maximum liberty person too, you know, and I think the left has to really reclaim that. And of course, constructive dialogue with anybody who wants to have constructive dialogue. But certainly, I would consider this a template for greater liberty in the society as well.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, FDR was really straightforward about that. He was quoting an elder figure of a previous generation, but and I'll put it in 21st century terms, needy people are not free people. Okay. Well, I mean, and if you imagine, and I've been talking a lot about the problems with the State of the Union message last week, and Alan always reminds me that besides the facts, besides the things he laid out, which were utterly inadequate, he never even mentioned, what do we do about the student debt? How can young people feel any sense of freedom when they are constrained by massive student debt? Whereas in the case of FDR and that generation, they saw educating young people by way of the GI Bill of Rights, by way of a whole host of initiatives, was the way that you not only enable young people to move ahead, but you enable the nation to move ahead. And by the way, that was Lincoln's idea what motivated him to sign the Land Grant Act back in the 1860s to create public universities around the country.
To me, that's how I know that we're not truly democratic here, because in a truly democratic place, the more educated, the better. We would want everybody to be as educated as they would want to be. And it wouldn't be a commodity. Like, it's not something that would be a profit-driven commodity. And it's that way because the truth is we don't want people to be smart.
And it's also,
we want people to be stupid.
It's much easier to hoard wealth when people are not as informed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and by the way, I want to say, in terms of libertarianism, and as I said, the free market is the sort of defining out, that is free under quotes. I mean, I think under neoliberalism, the idea of any free market, I think all markets are social constructs, and they're basically defined in our constitutional system by the elected officials who define the parameters of what's regulated, what's not regulated, and all the various mechanisms by which things come to market and go into play. And I think while, you know, people would look at what we're proposing is necessarily an expansion of the social welfare state, really only until it's needed. And other than that, we are still talking about what would be called a social democratic, but a capitalist society, in which I think there'd be incredible amounts of entrepreneurial opportunity because you have more people with greater life prospects and the opportunity to start businesses and get involved in that kind of enterprise. So yeah. I don't consider this to be anathema to people who see themselves as libertarian.
And the other thing to me is, when you give people things like healthcare and you allow them to do things like leave a job that they're stuck in because they can't give up their insurance, and the level of inspiration that creates, and then you cancel student debt, the boost to the economy that would create, like, this to me, these are things that would help capitalism. Because how can you have capitalism without consumers? I don't understand how anybody can really even be a consumer when they can barely afford to live.
Well, go ahead, Arby.
Well, I was just going to say, as we were talking, I was reminded of a couple of things. And one of them is the fact that, because we mentioned the welfare state, when FDR proposed the Economic Bill of Rights, it really was the case that workers, by way of their labor unions, were not pursuing benefits such as health care and other things that we now assume come with a well-paying sort of industrial, you know, the classic industrial job. Their assumption was that they were going to fight for universal health care. And it was only when corporations in the late 1940s saw how universal the desire was, and they feared losing the degree of control that they might have over their workers with corporate benefits, that they then gave way. And it was a famous Treaty of Detroit in the automobile industry, after the 1940s, the presumption was Americans secure their health care and other benefits through the workplace. But in fact, the labor movement had, from the beginning, sought to have a universal arrangement for those kinds of benefits. So in many ways, what we're trying to do is we're trying to redeem the vision of our grandparents and others, but give it a 21st century, you know, I hate to use the word spin, give it a 21st century appeal. And I want to add that what gives me hope in the possibilities is, on March 21st, well, a year ago, and you met my friend John Shelton, Peter and Jen, right? John's wife, who was a member of the state assembly and my representative in the state assembly, She and Francesca Hong from Madison put together a proposal for a Wisconsin Economic Justice Bill of Rights. And they've been getting a very good reading in the Democratic caucus down in Madison. On March 21st, there's going to be a relaunch of that initiative on the floor of the state capitol, which, and I'll be there myself. But also, a state representative in New Hampshire reached out to me, seeing this online and on the Common Dreams website, the proposal, and said, I have ideas for how we can push this thing in the states across the country. So, I mean, I know that's just little things, but it does have a kind of not only an historical appeal, but an historic appeal to the present day, I think.
Yeah, and we're getting great traction with the candidates that we're endorsing across the country because it is entered in as the final question of our candidate questionnaire. And so far, everybody who's filled out our PDA candidate questionnaire has said they agree with it. So we have a group of candidates who will be running across the country. Unfortunately, again, for Harvey and I, though, we did, of course, you can see the date that the article came out on Common Dreams. And, of course, it was pretty much, the day of that Putin actually invaded or the day after Putin invaded. So we're building up momentum on this, and we expect there will be an opportunity where we'll be able to focus as we head towards May. There was just the Texas primaries. The next primaries don't happen until the beginning of May. And, it's a very difficult kind of election cycle than we've seen in recent years, in part because of Ukraine, in part because of the redistricting and all the confusion that's gone into it. The incredible number of incumbents, not just Democrats, but Republicans who've stepped aside, creating open seats in the House. And then, the weird balance in the Senate where, you know, I know the Senate race is going to come into play in Florida, where you, of course, have a midterm election with a president with low poll numbers. And yet this particular election map is weighted very favorably for the Democrats, who could even pick up seats in the Senate and then therefore become maybe immune to Manchin and Sinema. And we could actually see some progressive measures pass. The other thing we're trying to do, too, at PDA is we're not really trying to turn off. There was an interesting dynamic that occurred within the House this past time, where the past cycle, no doubt assisted by the realities of the pandemic. But we had a lot of members of the House who you wouldn't think of as progressives who just went ahead. And there are only about 10 to 15 of them who spoke out against the Build Back Better agenda, which was much more, pointing in a progressive direction than we ever thought we'd see from a Biden administration. So, again, if the Democrats can hold on to the House, we can get some good progressives elected. They can expand the majority in the Senate. And it's the first part that's the biggest if. We understand where the polls are, how difficult it is for the incumbent party to hold onto a House when they have such a small majority going in. But if they do, I think we really could. I think if we see that happen, if we see those results, I think we'll see an even more willing to enact progressive legislation, Democratic Party heading to 2024 than we've seen before. And I think we can start to see some positive resolution of some of the things that have created a severe domestic crisis in the United States of America.
I was just going to ask, who are the candidates that you have coming up? Roger wants to know if you're running federal candidates or state candidates, and are you also pushing ballot initiatives?
Well, we primarily, Progressive Democrats of America is a federal PAC. And so we focus on federal candidates. We have a 501c4 that does lobby at the state, local, and national level. So we can, through that mechanism, endorse state and local candidates. I'm in charge of the federal operation, so I'm more familiar with the federal candidates. We did, because of the crazy year, though, we officially endorsed very few candidates going into Texas. We sort of endorsed 2.5 candidates there. Greg Kassar, who won, Jessica Cisneros, who forced a runoff against Henry Cuellar, and then we'll now endorse Jessica Crockett, who's going to replace Jasmine Crockett. Sorry. So many people.
I apologize. She's Jasmine. A friend. Yeah.
She's great. Yeah. And then a few other incumbents in Texas. But now we're moving out of Texas. We endorsed. I'm going to get his name right. I believe Maxwell Frost.
Yes.
See, there's your one solid
non-corporate, shining Florida beacon.
Yeah, like if you're going to put your eggs in a basket in Florida, put it in his basket.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we're going there. Well, we don't know what's going to happen in Deutsch's district and a few other places. Yeah,
we know what's going to happen. That's it.
Yeah, we know.
Okay. Well, we'll talk Moskowitz. I said it
correct.
Right.
He kept calling him. Yeah. What did you keep calling him?
Moskowitz?
Yeah, it's not like Mickey Mouse.
Sorry.
Now you have to be trying to know what a Moskowitz is. It's Moskowitz.
Sorry, but yeah, that's a seat that has been, the Democratic establishment has cleared the field. And Fred Guttenberg, who I'm sure you guys know, has christened him. Soon enough, Ted Deutsch will christen him.
Yeah, we already know who's getting that.
I hate to say it, but Mr. Moskowitz is, he's no different than Matt Gaetz in the sense that his father basically laid the foundation for his political career. And, nepepotism.
Nepepotism
is a very big problem in politics. Hey, that's why Charlie Crist might be our nominee all over again.
Yeah. And don't be surprised if that happens.
Yeah, that's very likely. So, yeah. But you know what? The good news is that in California, especially in Southern California, you really do have some solid candidates who have a puncher's chance of, you know, winning their races. Are there any in particular that really stand out from your perspective? I mean, we've had Angelica Duenas,
friend of mine. Yeah, good.
Obviously, David Kim, Shervin Azami, and also the lady's name that slipping me right now.
You actually expect me to remember?
Yeah, you know all that.
Well, if I see them, I'm like, okay, yeah, I met you. You think I know where most people? I mean. Yeah, and you expect me to remember their district numbers.
Bottom line, in your neck of the woods, you do have some solid candidates who could potentially knock off.
Well, we have two Garcias running to replace Alan Lowenthal. Robert Garcia and Christina Garcia both are quite progressive, and one of them will win. Okay, and then then Mike Ortega down in Santa Ana has a chance at knocking off a more conservative incumbent in Lou Correa, a very conservative incumbent Scott Peters, who's a Democrat down in San Diego, is going to face a grassroots challenge from a young woman named Kylie Titano. That's an exciting race in California. All over the country, look, I want to lift up Senator Vincent Fort. Many of the great progressive candidates are very young. Senator Fort is a two-decade veteran of the Georgia State Senate, where he was a real just a great progressive for two decades. And he's going to challenge David Scott in Georgia's 13th. And he has a real strong chance of winning there. And that would be a great shift to the left all the way now over in Oregon. Another kind of like Cisneros-Cuellar divide is between the very progressive Jamie McLeod Skinner versus the very reactionary Kurt Schrader among Democrats. So, again, that could be a big move to the left. Now, we're going to play a little defense. As of yesterday, we know that there's going to be a more moderate and centrist challenge to Ilhan Omar again in Minnesota. And I think Ilhan will survive that. I think these guys are wasting their money. I think we're going to see the same thing with Cori Bush.
Cori's getting a challenge.
Cori's likely. That's not announced yet, but it seems like they're setting up to run an establishment Democratic challenge against Cori Bush. And
Good luck with that.
Yeah, and by the way, I also think with the national spotlight off of Chantel Brown and Nina Turner, not in isolation, I think Nina could produce what would be.
You know what? I got to tell you, Alan, I think that's an excellent point. I think Nina would actually be served much better if there wasn't the entire spotlight on that race.
Well, that and most people honestly do not vote in most elections, let alone a special election.
Right. Yeah.
So that the voter turnout for a special election is pathetic.
And
so
not only that, but there are a lot of there's three state primaries on May 3rd. So there is going to be when Nina had her race with that person,
the other person,
all the attention was on that race. That is not going to be the case on May the 3rd. You know, you'll get the corporate, establishment that'll throw their.
It's likely to get delayed further, though, is my understanding, because of still legal wranglings about the shapes of the district.
Of course.
Similarly, they just, I think, set the date in North Carolina. I think Erica Smith is going to be a strong progressive in North Carolina.
We love Erica. That was supposed to be already, and they have already postponed that, I think, at least once.
That's right. I know these things go flying all over the place. And on down the line, all the way to September 13th, we have now David Siegel, one of the founders of Demand Progress, is going to run for an open seat in Rhode Island. But again, there'll be more people that we'll be bringing to the fore as things go forward. I'm a big supporter of someone named Doyle Canning out running for Peter DeFazio's seat. She's going to have a tough race running against the labor commissioner in the state of Oregon, who used to be the speaker of the assembly and therefore represented a good portion of the Eugene and Corvallis district. But that person, Val Hoyle, is a new Democrat, you know, literally supported by the blue dogs, as it were. And what we need in Eugene, if we don't get a real climate champion out of Eugene and Corvallis, going to the points you guys were making about, the necessity of the transformation of our energy system over to green energy, to renewable energy. it's tough right now. The institutional barriers to real to having real climate champions win in Democratic races is not insignificant. There are still forces operating inside the Democratic Party, even up in Oregon, that are not willing to get behind somebody who's going to challenge the rule of law of fossil fuel or whatever you want to call it.
That's what it is. That's what it's all about. And one thing that we've been talking about that I'm sure you guys have noticed lately is there is a very, I mean, look, obviously it's a lot more online than it probably is in person, if we're being fair about this, but there is a huge nihilistic movement on the left to basically say to hell with electoral politics, to hell with the Democratic Party. We don't want to be involved in any of this garbage. But what we believe is true, especially anybody who's interested in a third party run. We do not have the infrastructure for a third party, but you could technically be a third party if you focused exclusively on nonpartisan races, and they are all there: city council, county commission, school board. You want to support non-corporate candidates because you don't want to be part of the Democratic Party. The opportunity is there to run on those policies, and it costs a fraction of the money versus running for Congress. I would like to think that we could be making a collective effort to get those disenchanted people with regular, especially federal electoral politics, who might find that more appealing. Right now, it doesn't seem like we make a big enough effort to really focus on those seats. How do you guys see it?
Harvey.
Well, it's interesting to say that Green Bay is a nonpartisan mayor and city council. And as a consequence, there have been there have been real conservatives who've run and we know what their politics are. But there have been progressives who've run. And in fact, we have a relatively progressive mayor, but he came out of the state assembly as a Democrat. So they're identified. But it's not a bad thing. I mean, I know a lot of people who came out of the Bernie campaign really disenchanted with the Democratic Party. And in many a case, I think they were smart to run at the local level where one didn't have to even identify as a party person. One just ran as a progressive versus the status quo. Beyond that, it's hard to say, because what I was going to add before, and I don't mean to take back the question to national politics, is in the state of Wisconsin, we have a Senate race against Ron Johnson. Ron Johnson is the kind of guy, not to be insulting to Florida, but he's the kind of guy I would have expected to come out of Florida, not out of Wisconsin.
Oh, he gives Rick Scott a run for his money. No question.
Okay. No question. Well, so we have four candidates running, and they're all trying to, it's not unlike, not that you would know about it, the 1912 presidential campaign in the United States, where even the Republican Taft tried to present himself as a progressive. So the four Democrats running for the nomination are all posturing as progressives in the Democratic Party. One is decidedly more associated with the Clinton folks. And then there are three guys who are sort of jockeying. One is the current Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. One is, speaking of the sons of billionaires, Alex Lassery. But in fact, at least on his website and the labor support he has, he actually seems to be presenting one of the most progressive platforms to run on amongst the four of them. And then another fellow who's sort of running behind a bit, but who is now embracing our economic bill of rights. So who knows, he may well go to the four, and he's from the Fox Valley where I live at the north end of it. So there are these campaigns which could shake things up a bit. And I can only hope we get rid of Ron Johnson for a start.
Yeah, he unfortunately is the bottom of the barrel when it comes to our politics. And another example of, you lose Scott Walker and you got somebody like him. So there's always going to be this remnants of the infrastructure the Koch brothers were able to successfully build. But again,
that's right.
I think one of the biggest reasons why the Koch brothers have been so successful is because of the complete disintegration of labor in the United States, at least in terms of a labor movement. And I would think that a 21st century Bill of Rights is the ticket to changing that. So if you guys want to, run through real quick what this 21st century Bill of Rights is exactly, what it offers, and, what candidates obviously could be running on, what is in that 21st century Bill of Rights?
Okay. If you don't mind, Alan, I'll read them because they're not, we've kept them crisp, I think.
Yeah,
First of all, the right to a useful job that pays a living wage and to a voice in the workplace through a union and collective bargaining. FDR's Economic Bill of Rights did not include that, but that's because He had already signed into law the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, and the assumption was that the federal government would always stand behind workers' efforts to organize. The second, the right to comprehensive quality health care. By the way, 85% of Americans in 1944 wanted comprehensive quality health care. Number three, the right to a complete, cost-free public education and access to broadband internet. Four, the right to decent, safe, affordable housing. Number five, the right to a clean environment and a secure planet. Six, the right to a meaningful endowment of resources at birth and a secure retirement. And if I could just sidebar that and tell you, that in many ways is inspired by Thomas Paine's original vision of the Social Security plan that he laid out in the late 1790s, where he said young people should be afforded a stake, a grant to enable them to make something of their lives and to combat the possibility of poverty. Number seven, the right to sound banking and financial services. And finally, eight, the right to recreation and participation in public life. And I just want to say that FDR included the right to recreation in his call for an economic bill of rights back in 1944.
What is that? What's the right to recreation? Because I thought, you know, like to me, I'm hearing recreation and I'm going to add weed, like right to recreational weed. Like that's what I would like when I hear recreation. So like,
that's honestly what I thought of too.
Recreation at all. Right. Well,
okay. Two things I want to say, then I'll hand it over to Alan. The first one is that the commission that he had appointed in the 30s that was helping him develop this idea, they actually, I believe they said the right to adventure, which we talked about possibly including and wondered if people would sort of laugh if they saw the right to adventure.
But maybe we used a word that's become too archaic. It only recreation now only pertains to recreation weed.
Well, yeah, that's what I hear, but you know, I'm biased. But to me, that's the same kind of concept what you were saying before about what freedom only exists if you're free to make choices. And you only get that if you have a security net in which to live so that you can have choices. And so that is huge to me. And I always thought, yeah, pursuit of happiness, choices. So right. Yeah, that's recreation right. Is good. I mean, you know, are you talking leisure? Like, you know.
Yeah, I have little doubt that FDR had in mind leisure. And I have little doubt as well when he thought of his cousin, Teddy Roosevelt, that was the purpose of national parks, that people should be able to get away and have adventure in those kinds of settings.
Well, I see it also as paid vacation.
Vacation.
Yeah.
We don't have paid vacation guaranteed in this country, which is insane.
Yeah.
Every other country that's again, what the two things about this is one, to make clear to people that this is a template supported by progressive Democrats and that we want to see progressive Democrats run on this in 2022 and in 2024 and in 2026 till they get it, that this is their winning hand politically. OK. Secondly, that this is not a utopian fantasy. This exists pretty much in every other prosperous technological society in the world. So that's the East Asian country, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan. It's the other British colonial holdings around the world, like Australia, New Zealand, and Western Europe. Okay. In all of those countries, this and Canada, this basically exists. Okay. The United States doesn't. So the United States population is basically viewed by the American elites, our oligarchic class now is, you know, they're not worthy of this. They're not even going to be wise to ask for it. And we have to step forward and say, look, the Republican Party is not going to give you any of this. Trump basically campaigned saying he was going to be different. And what did he give you? He gave you more tax breaks for the rich, right? He turned on the fossil fuel spigot like never before. And he had some trade deals. So minor adjustment on trade he did provide. Okay. We know what the middle grouping is going to provide because they've been in power for the last 30 or 40 years. They stripped apart the central tenets that were building a middle-class society in the United States of America and gave us basically debt penury for the masses and all the money going upward into the coffers of the investor class. So, you know, that's the society we live in currently, and we want to shift it back. And there's a template to shift it back, which was provided by FDR, who, by the way, provided the template for all those other countries that have these things.
Right.
He basically created it. They adopted it. And in fact, veterans of the Roosevelt administration and the Truman administration, and then the Truman administration, they basically wrote a lot of the constitutions in Western Europe that generated this prosperity for the Western Europeans. And pretty much probably the Japanese, too, though they have quite a sort of distinctive model compared to the Western Europeans. But the result is the same, largely. You have universal health care. You have very little poverty. You have very high social indices in all these countries and very low. If you take out aggregate wealth as an index for the United States of America, we're at the bottom of all the other social welfare indices when it comes to mass incarceration, drug addiction, family structure, mental health, diet,
maternal and infant mortality rate, and life expectancy. We're the worst.
Yeah, all of those things. And you have to excuse me, I got to get a plug to keep this running. You guys,
I am going to tell you one thing though, to go back to labor references, and I'm a labor unionist, I wouldn't want to fail to do that. Think about that original call of the labor movement in the late 19th century. 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours for what we will. And it's the what we will. And if you want to include recreational weed in there, you go right ahead.
I think we can absolutely include civil liberties. And I also think that it's incumbent upon us to also recognize how important it is to not also neglect foreign policy and how much the way that things are happening right now is a reflection of the vulnerabilities. You know, Putin in many ways waited for the perfect opportunity to expose what a flawed system we have here in the U.S. and how even if you can sanction the hell out of Russia, we do not have the infrastructure in place. We do not have the economy in place to withstand literally chopping out the legs of one of the three global superpowers. And on top of that, we are also a very vulnerable nation regarding our wherewithal to what is really going on. You know, we look at these things and think we could just flip a switch and yeah, that'll fix the problem. No, we've become a very entitled nation in the sense that, you know,
we've always been an entitled nation.
Yeah. But we're also not, we don't have a collective mindset, as you like to say. So this idea of my personal comfort is infinitely more important than the comfort of everybody, making sure that we can all survive. And we're seeing that now. And this 21st century Bill of Rights is as much of an important component to our daily lives that we need more than ever. And right now, when things are really the worst, that's when you really need to have the voices that are going to be the loudest about this, because we could easily have Trump again. We could easily have DeSantis. And they're, you know, again, it's kind of like the movie Don't Look Up. It's, well, I guess if all goes to hell, I'll just hitch a ride on the rocket ship. And,
well, that's what Rick Scott is already planning his escape pod. Like he doesn't deny climate. He just wants us, his disciples, to deny climate.
And that's what's amazing, because the 21st century Bill of Rights, which includes the prospect of dealing with the environment, having, let's say, a Green New Deal, now more than ever, I think the biggest mistake, and again, unfortunately, as we know, we do not have the best leaders in many ways, even the ones that are in elected office, when it comes to conveying the message that needs to be conveyed about these types of policies. Mm-hmm. If you want to convince people that we have to move to a clean energy economy, you have to show them that the economy is what it leads with. The environment is basically the benefit that comes with it. Yes, the environment is in dire straits, but people will frack themselves to death, as the saying goes. They will. And so the only way we're going to stop it is if we show them that economically speaking, it makes complete sense to have, let's say, solar fields, to have wind farms, Alan, as they have off of Interstate 10 between LA and Palm Springs. So when you have those types of things that can really change the game, you just have to show people how it benefits them economically. If they can see that, if they can see right now that one of the biggest problems that we're facing, if you have, let's say, $5 a gallon gas, $7 a gallon gas, if it costs you $40 to go 200 miles in an internal combustion engine car, and if you did it with a car that has a battery and you go 200 miles, it costs you $9.
Right.
As far as I'm concerned, That's the message that needs to be repeated over and over and over again. Because whether it's economic, environment, and foreign policy, all of it is interconnected now. And I think now more than ever, people are going to see it, because this conflict in Ukraine, this is not ending anytime soon, despite what people may think.
Right. And MBS tipped his hand today as to where he's going to put his weight and pressure on. It's going to fall right into the pockets of U.S. consumers if they continue to pump oil. And it's going to go right into the Saudi coffers.
But you know what? If they keep the gas prices where they are for even a few weeks,
right,
you're going to have talks of marching on Washington. It's going to happen pretty fast. And it should happen.
And that's the thing. Exactly. And that can be devastating for the Democrats in the midterm. It can be devastating for the party of the incumbent if they don't act. And the act has to be so our little slogan from our staff meeting today was a little bit more familiar word other than the way I'll say it, but it was screw Putin, go green. Right. I mean,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right.
If you want. And again, it's sanctions. And this is what's so interesting. And we can wind down the conversation on this point. You know, during one of the worst parts about having our congressional representative, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, you know, everybody talks about, you know, everything that transpired during, you know, obviously the 2016 primary and how she helped tip the scales for Hillary against Bernie. You know, when it comes to what she does at the local level, there is nothing she is worse on than foreign policy. And one of the things that she has been a tremendous advocate for is regime change in Venezuela. She has had Juan Guaido down here many times. This advocacy for this imperialistic foreign policy is amazing. But yet right now, because guess what, ladies and gentlemen, 25% of the crude oil supply in the world is under Venezuela's soil. And that is exactly why we have sanctioned the hell out of them, because we want it and we don't want Russia to have their hands on it. Well, guess what? Now we are on our knees with the real president, Mr. Maduro, and we are going to lift those sanctions because they are apparently embracing capitalism. Because we have something they want, and we now can't paint them as the socialist nut jobs. So pay close attention to how this works, because eventually we're going to run out of places to go. And if we were really America first, we would be building that clean energy infrastructure right now. And amazingly enough, guys, President Biden, he has the authority to do a lot of things, including declare a national economic emergency. And what is it that he could do with infrastructure? Like he can help me out, guys.
The thing that they kept talking about in terms of the pandemic production of masks.
The production. Right.
So if you wanted to go mass production on geothermal, biofuel, wind farms, hydroelectric plants, and solar fields, you could be doing that right now. Mm-hmm. Right now, there is nothing that is stopping the president of the United States from declaring a national emergency and saying we have to do these things. He's only issued, amazingly enough, President Biden has only issued 80 executive orders. FDR issued almost 4,000. So this idea that he is not capable of doing something is nonsense. And we know that.
I want to piggyback off that if I can very quickly.
Yeah.
One thing that the United States has, you talk about geopolitical, the chessboard, as it were. The key to the international chessboard, and this goes all the way back to something FDR pulled off, by the way, with his pact with the Saudis before we went into World War II, was who was going to control the world's oil supply. Okay, now we have to get off of oil. What are the assets that the United States has? I would argue that we have more assets than any other country in the world, in particular because we have the lion's share of university scientific research capacity within the domestic United States of America. As maleducated as our population, all the elite scientists in the world come to faculties at American universities, and there's nothing like the land-grant universities. I mean, some of the campuses in Florida, by the way, are spectacular. You go and see these great universities in Europe, whether it's Oxford, Cambridge, the Sorbonne, or whatever, their physical plants pale in comparison. Well, what's the expanse of the physical plant is largely scientific research capacity. So this is the place where all of the hiccups in zero carbon emission renewable energy can be worked out. What's the storage capacity? How do you keep it going? How do you expand storage capacity? How do you make a fully operative renewable energy system can be developed? The country with the best angle on its development, if it's funded, is the United States of America. Then we can bring these models out to the rest of the world. And Saudi Arabia is defanged. Russia, with all of its resources, can hopefully be beyond Putin within a few years, and it can develop as a prosperous and peaceful society as well. But it won't be necessarily a petro state, but it is currently operating as a petro state. And if we can get beyond global dependence on oil, the United States needs to lead on that. It's the best positioned country to lead on it. And those corporations with the fossil fuel that they produce are a huge, huge barrier to that on Capitol Hill, just as you were saying at the top of the show. And yeah, they remain a huge barrier.
Oh, no.
Joe Manchin was a full-on bulldozer for them this past year.
Well, before you guys go, I'm going to bring out a friend.
Uh-oh, so. Who do we have? Okay. Oh, no.
Well, I just want, of course, I can't see very straight, but, you know, Alan, it's really nice to see you as well. So remember that the 21st century Bill of Rights it should be part of your daily lives. You should remember that you are entitled to live a decent life. So thank you guys for coming on the show. We really appreciate all that you're talking about. And make sure that you support PDA and you support public education. You guys are fantastic. Jen, you're good to see you. I'm not running for a third term, so don't ask. I don't have time. I can't take it anymore. But hopefully the people will start to rise up and we will get the job done. Because if the gas prices stay that way, I'm not going to be able to drive back to Vermont. I can't afford it. It's too much money.
So wait a second. Is that Bernie Sanders or Jackie Mason?
Sort of a cross-eyed Bernie Sanders.
I knew who it was, but the last bit was so Jackie Mason.
But I appreciate.
Do you know who Jackie Mason is? I'm sorry.
Of course.
I know you do. Does he know who Jackie
Mason is? He actually does know that kind of stuff.
Oh, Bernie probably knows Jackie Mason. Come on.
Self-deprecating humor is how I made it through politics all these years. So, of course, that's fine. But I appreciate you guys. Wonderful that you're doing such a wonderful job. And
all right. We got to move on.
Thank you very much. Excellent.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And shout out to Mitchell Stolberg, by the way.
Huge loss in terms of any sense of real organization in Broward and any real actions or any, like, it's palpable.
We're trying to talk some sense into some of the local up and coming leaders here to sort of humble themselves and recognize where their efforts are best used in regards to building that infrastructure. Some want to, you know, jump to the moon, but you can't put the car before the horse. And that seems to be a big problem. And that is why if we really start advocating at the local level for this type of issue, the 21st Century Bill of Rights, which will cover all those aspects of, as you were even talking about, Alan, when you want to talk about real economic freedom for everybody, this is where it's at, baby. You know, why do we want a living wage? We want a living wage because we don't want people to live on welfare. Mm-hmm. This idea that you think that, oh my God, we want people to pay a living wage. Yeah, but we don't want to be taking money from Uncle Sam either. Right. We want to be able to sustain ourselves.
That's the difference. Well, that's the jobs guarantee.
Yes. But conservatives have done a really great job for a long time convincing people. And that's really the evolution that's changed, Harvey, particularly in the last generation. It used to be you would get criticized for not having a job. Today, you get criticized for having a job that isn't good enough. That to me is so out of sight, out of mind.
Well, jobs are more valuable than others. Not everybody is worthy of making a living wage. Certain people.
Is Rick Scott inhabited your body? Harvey Kay, Alan Minsky, anything you guys want to plug before you go, please share with the audience.
Where can people find all this stuff?
Anything that you want to talk about, as well as the Economic Bill of Rights.
The Economic Bill of Rights is posted. Well, our call for an Economic Bill of Rights is posted at Common Dreams. If you go to Common Dreams and plug in Minsky or Kay or whatever, it'll come right up. Okay. And the other thing I want to say is that people should treat this not as something that is impossible. It is decidedly possible, and I think the time might be now to get real traction going.
Thank you, and I'll just end with pdamerica.org, not a double A there, pdamerica.org, and if you want to contact us, info@pdamerica.org.
Okay. Yeah, guys, always check out your local PDA also.
If anybody wants to follow me on Twitter, it's Harvey J. Kaye.
Alan, how about you?
Oh, I just do at PD America.
PD America. It was very nice to meet you, by the way.
Oh, great to meet you, too. Thank you. I remember you from the Mitchell's Memorial Service and, of course, as a candidate as well.
Yeah, that was hard. And I would also like to, you know, as soon as we talk about Mitchell, I'm like, Mitchell would be alive if we had healthcare.
Yes, he would.
And wasn't having to work two jobs during, you know, like pre-pandemic.
Yeah, and the saddest part about it is
driving a friggin' Uber when he is like a vulnerable person.
I had a conversation with him a few days before he died, and I specifically told him, you know, you're going to run yourself into the ground. And it hurt me, not because he was stubborn. It's because he had no choice.
No, that's the point.
And we really need to recognize where we are right now. And that's why I think this conversation, building these relationships, are so vital. Because if there is one thing that made the Tea Party so effective is that they were a well-oiled machine. They had a mission. They knew what they were wanting to do. And that was before the Koch brothers got to them when they went for federal seats. But at the local level, they took over, baby. They got what they wanted, and they started in like 2006 they actually started. It was even before Obama got elected.
It was, but it was definitely very reactionary to the black president situation.
There was definitely a growth to that fact.
Serious cognitive dissonance.
But they had a mission, they had a goal, and they got it done. And the progressives need to recognize, and you can't even say the word progressive anymore. You got to say non-corporate. That is what it is. If we are going to focus on our growth, it has to be this non-corporate movement that is going to be the game changer. And we welcome the opportunity to grow these relationships. And you guys are doing a fantastic job. We need to be having it more, these conversations more often. We hope you guys will come back again in the near future. Thanks. I know you will. Harvey K., Alan Minsky.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Have a great night, guys. So as you can see, we have we've done ourselves, he was there and now he's gone. Yeah. Shahid, he says he's got another appointment.
No worries. We can definitely reschedule. This happens.
Sorry, Shahid.
For candidates. Yes. Sorry, Shahid.
Yes, no, but this was a very important conversation. It was a very important conversation.
Love those guys.
Yes. And yes, sorry about Shahid Buttar, guys. We will have him on. And yes, Joe,
it's hard with candidates.
It is non-corporate. That is the word, because you can lie about being a progressive. You cannot lie about being non-corporate.
Right. It's either you do or do not take the money.
Do.
Because if you look at the amount of people in Congress, look at the Congressional Progressive Caucus, there's over 100 something people in that caucus.
And you would not say probably even half of them are really progressive.
No. I would say maybe 5 of them are progressive.
Yeah.
But like, you know, so there's over 100 people in the Congressional. Nancy Pelosi is a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
Well, of course I'm progressive.
So point being, anybody could say that they're anything.
Does it mean that they are?
But if you suckle at the teat of the corporations, then you are in fact a corporate whore.
Booyah.
By the way, if you guys are not familiar with comedian Kyle Dunnigan, you should definitely check him out. Yes, Carla, that's what I'm talking about. And he does an impression of Nancy Pelosi called Batshit Money. It's really funny. But of course, I'm rubbing those knuckles.
All right, so what do we have coming up?
Well, as we told you guys, we are going to be going on Status Quo with Jordan Chariton on Friday at 5:30 p.m. I'm pretty sure it's the time. And we will be talking about this horrific anti-solar bill that they bipartisanly passed in the Senate here in Florida. And we know DeSantis is going to sign it into law because he is running for president and he needs all that corporate cash.
Yeah, people, stop thinking that he's running for governor. He already won that.
It's already over.
That's over. He's running for president now. And the only people that sadly don't seem to know this are the Democrats. So like they're going to be like late to the party as usual. They're going to be like, when'd that happen? It's happening.
If you guys like our work, and I think you do, and
please,
you
are
not, you know, not currently supporting our efforts, would really hurt our feelings.
Does Jen get the munchies? Yes.
Yeah, of course. How could you not?
I do. But here's the thing though, in all fairness to me, I'm sort of like, whether I'm high or not high, I munch or not munch. Like, it's not necessarily related. Like, I'm just kind of a snacker.
Yeah.
I'm a snacker. I don't eat like meals very much.
Jen's a rabbit.
I'm not. No, but I eat, like, I'll eat junk. Don't get me wrong. I love my junk. That's my biggest problem is my sweet tooth.
For as little as $5 a month, you can become a Patreon.
Yeah, guys, be a Patreon.
But if you pay $10 or even $25 a month, you can help us build an even bigger network, which is what we are doing. If you guys like our efforts, because the one thing that we always point out is that we do not take a salary. Every dollar that we raise as part of our Patreon goes towards local and even state and, in certain circumstances, federal efforts. So if you like what we have to offer,
non-corporate candidates, and local initiatives,
causes.
And yeah.
So if you guys believe in that and you think that our channel is on the level, I would like to think that we are. I think we do a pretty
decent
job.
Where are you, Carla Joy? Cisco, where is she?
Yeah, Carla, where are you?
Carla Joy, Tell Cisco, where are you running?
Where are you running for Congress, Carla? Tell us.
We'll have you on.
We'll have you come on the podcast.
Unless you take the corporate money, but you probably wouldn't be watching us.
You never know. Could be one of those people who wants to change. You know, somebody watched our video the other day and didn't like the fact that I went after Representative Wasserman Schultz because she wanted to play the victim again about how she had cancer. Well, guess what? I don't have any sympathy for somebody who could actually do something about it and doesn't support universal health care.
Exactly. You don't get sympathy for that when you don't realize everyone else is entitled to your same level of care.
Bingo!
It's infuriating. And by the way, and on behalf of my friend Rita, who watches sometimes, maybe not now, who is also a cancer survivor, it infuriates her to no end that Debbie Wasserman Schultz takes money from the alcohol industry, which there is no linkage between alcohol and breast cancer.
Of course.
So do not play the, I'm just saying. So don't get me started. When you're going to play the cancer survivor card.
It's now, just, to be fair, one of the commentators who had a negative thing to say, of course, had to talk about how we support that loser, Nina Turner. So once you say that, that's it. You've given away the game. The game's been given away. It's over.
No, okay. So what we have coming up on Monday is, this is exciting, actually.
Guys, you are in for an interesting treat. You may like him, you may not like him, but he's got a huge following, almost 1 million followers.
This is a good opportunity for us, guys. So, you know, fingers crossed. This could be like a Vosh boost type of thing, depending on. I mean, because if anybody can appeal to atheists, it's this person.
Well, with that said, we are going to have on The Amazing Atheist.
Yay!
So,
and before that, we're going to be speaking with, I caught something in news the other day, about this.
One thing we can say about the state of Florida is that even though things are really dire down here in Southeast Florida, things in Central Florida are actually becoming very progressive, especially in the Orlando metro
area. And there is a gentleman who has started an organization called YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard, that is promoting housing justice and really working for solutions in Central Florida. And we're going to be talking to him because it just looked like he was somebody I wanted to meet. I do. That is the one thing. I feel like I do use this show to meet people that I want to meet.
Carla, we highly recommend, especially if you're, you know, disillusioned with the Democratic Party or just, you know, corporate politics in general in Texas.
Sorry, Carla.
Texas is such a difficult state. No, Greg Cazar is, you know, the progressive one. But, you know, what we will say is that we are really pushing this collective effort to have people running for local nonpartisan seats. And we know how expensive it is to run, especially for Congress in the state. Well, actually, no, there's no state laws in Texas. So if you're running for the state house or the Senate, you can spend whatever you want. But city council, county commission, school board costs a lot less money.
My friend Ina's seat is going to be up. Apparently she's running for judge. So they're losing a leftist, unfortunately.
Well, everybody's going conservative in the judges' houses these days.
Well, so it's good to have somebody that isn't.
That's true.
So that's a good thing.
We need more lawyers.
Okay, so Monday we're going to be speaking about housing, and we're going to be speaking with The Amazing Atheist, which that should be very interesting.
And do we have Wednesday, the next Wednesday covered as well?
I'm trying to get to where...
I think we may.
You think? Okay, yes, we do. So on Wednesday, we're going to be speaking with candidate Cynthia Mendez. Where is she?
She is running for lieutenant governor in Rhode Island. And she is running on, this is a very important conversation because she is running on one of those slates. She is not running by herself. She is running as part of a non-corporate group. And
that's what we're trying to do.
And
then we're also talking with Dr. John Cobb, and I have no idea who that is.
Dr. John Cobb is a gentleman who is coming on our podcast who is going to talk about.
For a second, I thought that said Gerard Butler, and I was going to flip the F out.
I'm not that good yet.
Did that say Gerard Butler?
No. No.
Oh, Gutter Guard. I thought it said Gerard Butler.
Yeah, no, okay. That's not.
Sorry, I got so excited.
So we are, but we are going to be speaking with John Cobb, who is going to come on and talk about. And he's in California, and he is almost a centenarian. Is that how you say? Yeah, he has seen a lot, and he is here to talk about what we are doing to the environment and how we can save it, God willing.
And wait. So where is that from, though? Like, where did you get?
They reached out to us. A lot of people want to come on our show.
Well, and also we get cold calls too, because there's publicists that put it out to everybody on social media that hits a certain demographic.
That may be true, but I'd like to pretend like we're important.
We're so important. We are here.
We're totally important, very important.
All right. People. So, yeah, we've got next week. Yeah. Taken care of. That's really good.
We're really getting ahead of the schedule.
We're moving.
We're moving on up. So with that said, we appreciate you guys. Share, like, subscribe.
Be patrons.
Comment. Do everything you
be
can.
Be patrons.
We appreciate you. And hopefully.
Oh, we'll fire breathing Rob.
And hopefully we will see you on Friday for Status Quo. And then we will see you next Monday.
Yeah, guys, support Status Quo.
Yep. All right, guys.
Bye, all. Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.